Sai Ram, and welcome to this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth, show where you can drop your questions, confusions and dilemmas, and I, Prem from Team Radio Sai, equipped with Swami's message, of course, comes up with solutions and explanations for your questions. That's why this is the Answering Booth. But before the answers or even the questions, as always, let us begin by offering our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet, for he is the source of the answers and the source of the questions too. Sometimes when you come to think of it, life is really a quest, and we have a series of questions for which we are constantly seeking answers, isn't it? And it is in search of these answers we pave our life's journey itself. At times it feels it doesn't matter what the answer is, because if we observe, the answers to the same questions change with time. When we were children, we were constantly asked, what would you like to be when you grow up? When we just look at the answer to this one question over the years, we will realize how it has changed as we grow. For the answer literally grows with us. So probably more than the answer itself, what probably matters is how much the answer has changed over the years. And as we go through life, what becomes more and more important is where we seek these answers from. Whom do we turn to when we have dilemmas, and whose advice we eventually follow? Well, some of us might say we turn to Swami's message for answers, of course. That's very fine. But what's important is when we turn to Swami for answers, whom do we perceive Swami as? Certainly, each of us are entitled to our own perceptions, but we must ensure that our actions are consistent with that perception of Swami, especially when we look for answers in Swami's message. The second half of today's show, I would like to narrate one very profound incident of how Swami literally constructed this perception of who He is for a simple family, and how it changed the course of their lives thereafter. That's of course after the question for the week. I'm just giving you a heads up so you can hang around. But before all of that, I will have to read for you a quote that has caught my attention, and I'm sharing it with all of you with a fond belief that it will thrill and inspire you just as it has thrilled and inspired me. The quote I'm going to read out is from a person whom I can probably describe as the all-time youth icon of India. The words I'm about to share with you, dear listeners, are the words of the fiery monk Swami Vivekananda. And I quote, "The Vedanta recognizes no sin. It only recognizes error. And the greatest error, says the Vedanta, is to say that you are weak, that you are a sinner, a miserable creature, and that you have no power and you cannot do this and that." End of quote. There is no sin, there are only errors. Because sin is like an eternal flaw. Sinner is a definition given based on one's few or many sinful acts. But what we do are merely errors. Errors that can be corrected with conscious effort. Time and our actions have in them the ability to right every error. When we have that ability in us, how can mistakes be sins? How can we be sinners? That divine ability to set right every wrong is there in each of us. We are in that sense supremely empowered. We have a choice, an all-important choice of what we relate to. Do we relate to those errors and call ourselves sinners? Or do we relate to that power and call ourselves as Amritasya Putra, heirs to immortality, as Vedanta says? As Swami Vivekananda says, Vedanta urges us to identify with that divine ability that lies within us. We are not weak, for how can we be weak when the Almighty Lord resides within us? And in fact, He is our reality. And the Swamiji beautifully points out how we label ourselves sinners for our many transgressions, without realizing that the greatest transgression is to label ourselves as sinners. Because when we do that, we justify our mistakes. We give ourselves license to fail. We resist the transformation within. Swami would repeatedly tell us, first and foremost, assert to yourself, I am not an animal, I am man. For being a man is itself a responsibility, and we are escaping that by calling ourselves sinners. So before we move on with the program, dear listeners, permit me to read for you that quote of Swami Vivekananda one more time. I quote, The Vedanta recognizes no sin. It only recognizes error. And the greatest error, says the Vedanta, is to say that you are weak, that you are a sinner, a miserable creature, and that you have no power and you cannot do this and that. So it's time to head to our question of the week. The question is from Sister Shruti Gopal. I will be playing for you her question, but in the voice of our volunteer, Sister Sumna. After we listen to the question, let's try and answer that for her.
Sai Ram Prem, it is so nice that you are doing answering booth on Radio Sai. I have been meaning to send you this question for a long time, but somehow it got left. I was reminded of it when listening to Radio Sai. I hope that you won't mind giving your thoughts about this, and my question is as follows. When we have completed our best efforts for getting something in life, it is easier to surrender to Swami and accept the results as His wish and believe that whatever He gives will be for our good. But when we are still in the process of doing our efforts over some time, for example, over some months or years, can we still surrender to Swami? And how can we do this because we are actively involved in doing the efforts? How can we think that whatever He gives is for our good? Because it could be that our effort is still pending. How do you determine how long to put in efforts for and when to surrender to Swami? I hope this question makes sense. I would really appreciate your views. With kind regards, Shruti.
Thank you, Sister Shruti, for that question. Your question certainly makes sense, and in fact, it's a very important one. I'll first try to rephrase your question just to emphasize some of the points that you raise. It's easy to surrender when the efforts have to be done within a time frame. For example, say when we are giving an exam. The effort is still the date of the exam, right? So clearly we can put our efforts and then surrender to God. It's again easy when there are limited options before us. Say in the case of a medical emergency, and let's say one of our dear ones is undergoing a treatment for a particular health condition, and we have about 5 procedures that we can try out. In such a case, we can exhaust all our options and then say, God, thy will be done. But it becomes complicated when there is no boundary like this, right? Let us say you're pursuing something that calls for efforts over years, as you mentioned, and at any point in between, you could stop putting efforts and say, this is it. It could be attempts at business, pursuing research, or even working on a strained relationship. In such situations, we will always be left with this doubt as to, is it that it was Swami's will that it didn't happen, or was it that I didn't put enough effort on my part? I think this is a situation that most of us will face, and it comes to us in many, many forms. Alright, at the very outset, this confusion that all of us face comes from the misconception that surrender is passive, inactive, or actionless acceptance. There is one saying that I've heard so many times as I was growing up, and after coming to Swami, many a times I wondered that there's something wrong with that saying or with the way we understand it. Probably I should put it that way. The saying is, do the best and leave the rest to God. Right? I always wonder why should doing our best and leaving it to God be mutually exclusive at all? Even as we are doing our best, we must do it with the belief that God will do the rest, right? In other words, surrender is not another act that it must follow our efforts. But surrender is actually an attitude with which we must begin making our efforts, an attitude we must have even as we are making our efforts, and also when we are awaiting our results after completing our efforts. In one sense, we can also say that there is a gradual movement towards this ideal state of surrender. in this, I feel, is very well understood through the concept of the Navavidha Bhakti, or the ninefold path of devotion. We had a long series as part of the afternoon satsang, but I will give you a brief summary here, only of the relevant portion. And I feel each of us can observe our own attitudes as we make efforts and see if we are progressing towards the higher levels of surrender. In the Navavidha Bhakti, or the Eightfold Path, the ultimate stage is called Atmanivedanam. This is a stage of complete surrender where one gives up even one's own identity. But there are three stages that occur before that that can be seen as incremental steps towards that perfect surrender. And they are Vandanam, Archanam and Dasyam. The stage of Vandanam is similar to someone who has had an illustrious career, has plenty of achievements to one's credit, and still there is humility and one bows down before the Lord. Another way of looking at it is, say I've chosen a career, I've started a business, or I've decided I want to be a doctor or whatever. After I make the choice, I work hard, and somewhere that thought is there that I will be able to offer all this at God's feet in Swami's service. So here the primary idea is that you wish to achieve something and you are prepared to do, and you are prepared to do it with an attitude of offering. In this stage, we will see the results as most important, because we have the feeling that I can offer only the results to Swami, right? So we will keep making efforts. If efforts don't work, we try out different methods of putting the same efforts, and we'll strive to achieve the results that we had set out to achieve. In fact, it could even be that in this stage, we and our ambition is important, and God, prayer, even surrender is a means to achieve what we have set out to achieve. In this approach, the effort, the contemplation, the completion and the grace is judged purely based on the results. The next level is where the effort itself becomes an offering. When we start following the dictum, work is worship, duty is God. Here, either our choices or life's course has led us to a certain situation in life, be it being an employee in a firm, a homemaker, mother, a student, a teacher, whatever it is. So you do whatever you do as an offering to God. You don't look to offer the results or achievements, but everyday activity becomes an offering to God. This is the stage when surrender starts becoming more of an attitude. Here, as you mentioned, there is a level of acceptance when it comes to the results. We will say, Swami, whatever happens, I accept your will. Both failure and success. Of course, there is still the question, how do we know if we have put more effort or we have put enough effort or we can relax? I will come to that point in a short time. For now, let us look at the action itself and how this attitude of any result is acceptable to me changes the way we act itself. Firstly, when I say I want every action of mine to be an offering, it automatically means that work has to be the best, right? Even if we are offering a flower to Swami, we pick the best, right? So the action we perform will start acquiring a level of excellence the moment I say my actions have to be offered to Swami. This is what Swami would refer to when he would quote, Yoga Karmashu Kaushalam. Yoga is, as we know, union with God, which is the goal of surrender. So how does yoga reflect in the performance of karmas or actions? It reflects as skillfulness or perfection. Yoga karma sukaushalam. Yoga in action is excellence. The moment I say I wish to offer this action to Swami, I will have to make it perfect. You know, when we were in the hostel in Vrindavan, we would have a tradition. Whenever Swami is there, the students too would send food for Swami. So we had a dietary department where boys would cook and send a carrier of food for Swami. And obviously we were not the best of cooks. So the puris would not always be in the perfect shape. All the pagodas will not be evenly fried. So the boys would invariably prepare a little more when it comes to such dishes. And then the best would be picked out from the lot and would be packed and sent to Swami. I think this is what people who have the habit of offering food at Swami's altar at home also do, right? Pick the best of what they cook and offer it to Swami. once, I'd like to contrast this with another conversation which we had, because we were talking to an elderly devotee who had the rare blessing of being in Swami's kitchen and also who had the chance to serve Swami sometimes. This elderly devotee was telling us that during the Gram Seva time, one box of the tamarind rice that was prepared for distribution would also be kept on Swami's own table. And this is not specially prepared or anything. From the same kitchen where it was prepared for distribution in the villages, one box would be brought. Now, doesn't it go without saying that those people cooking will now have to ensure that whatever they make is of such quality that it is suitable for being placed on Swami's table? Now, what is the difference between the two examples I gave? The first example is the case with most of us. We pick and choose what activities we offer to Swami. We do many actions, we pursue many goals, but we pick what we think are suitable to be offered, right? And mentally we make this offering to Swami. But what happens the moment the whole thing becomes an offering? Because the idea was that Swami wanted that when they cook for Gram Seva, people would cook with the idea that it is being offered to Swami. So he ensured that they cook with that attitude by having one casserole of that food got straight to his table, right? Similarly, when all actions become an offering, we will tend to do everything with caution to ensure it is perfect. So surrender during the performance of action shows as perfection. Yogaha karmasu kaushalam. Before we move on, let me make one point here. You know, people generally say that Swami is a perfectionist, Swami always wants perfection in everything, he wants the best and so on. And I feel we tend to get confused with that, we misunderstand that a bit. This really does not mean that Swami wants only the best. Because it is when we think this way that we tend to pick and offer only the best. Really, if Swami wanted only the best, I wouldn't be sitting here. Swami's students would not be singing bhajans, right? Swami would have only professional experts all around him. When we say Swami was a perfectionist, what it really means is, Swami would look into every detail when he would do something, and he wanted us to emulate that. Whatever we do, can we give our best, our complete involvement? I hope you're following the difference there. Swami did not want us to do 100 things and offer the best among that 100 to him. He wanted us to offer everything to him, continuously striving to do our 100% in each of those 100 things we do. Because this is nothing but mindfulness that is spoken about in Zen philosophy, right? Being in complete awareness every moment. So Swami has not come to pick and use in his mission the best among us. That's not the idea. Swami wants that each of us are able to offer all that we do to him, striving for excellence in every single act we perform. And this is an ongoing process which we all have to work at. And in many, many discourses, if you see, Swami will eventually come to this point of doing work as worship. But along with this act of offering should come the attitude of accepting the results as prasadam. Whatever is the result, it is Swami's gift. I think I've mentioned these points earlier too, but nevertheless, when this attitude of accepting everything as prasadam happens, we will start seeing no difference between success and failure, loss and gain, pleasant and the unpleasant, what we wanted and what we didn't want. In other words, you become equanimous. In fact, Swami defined surrender as acceptance of both good and bad equally. Swami had written way back in 1947 in that letter to his brother, Manchi cheddalu kuda manasulo samamuga bhavinchuchundute bhakti naku. To consider good and bad as equal is devotion in my definition. So on one hand, we will be more careful with our actions and try to do our best, which is also part of surrender. And on the other hand, we will constantly be open to receive anything as a result. So if I were to use mathematical expressions, as we grow in surrender, our actions tend to infinite perfection and our expectations of results tend to zero. Generally, how do we judge our efforts? Now this is very important. We use multiple parameters to see if we have put in all efforts necessary, right? Firstly, there is a little bit of self-satisfaction when we feel we have done our part. Then the result of our efforts. Have the results we expected when we started making the efforts been achieved? Or say in the case of an exam, the percentage of marks or the rank we get is used to judge the quality of our efforts. Then, to an extent, we judge our efforts based on others' judgment of our efforts. Let's say I'm working in a company, based on what my boss thinks of me, what my colleagues think of me, what my appraisal says, I judge if I have put in enough effort. Sometimes we compare our results with others. And actually speaking, though I'm making different points, all of these are different forms of results that we seek for our efforts, that we look for when we are pursuing efforts. When we start doing work with the attitude of surrender, as I've explained so far, all these results, the final outcome, what others think of our efforts, comparatively how we stand, all of these start tending towards zero. Or in other words, start becoming irrelevant. So what is the one factor that is remaining now? The self-satisfaction, right? So the more we do our actions as offering to Swami, we will start judging the quality of our actions on the basis of our self-satisfaction more and more. So to the question, when do you know if you have made enough efforts in the pursuit of a certain goal? One way is do till you feel self-satisfaction. If you stop making the effort and you feel guilty about it, or you feel that at some later point in your life you will look back with disappointment, then certainly do more. Don't take it that I'm saying the end result should not mean anything at all. Yes, we should use that also as a means of judging our efforts. For example, say you're a teacher in a school. You take lessons for your class sincerely. But there is one student who is not able to follow you, and as a result, the student is failing. As a teacher, you say this student is doing badly, which means I should either slow down in my teaching or make efforts to tutor him separately and try to find out what's the real issue. In this case, you are clearly using the result to judge your actions in a very practical way. But if you are a teacher who has surrendered, all the while you're still working only for self-satisfaction. And you know only effort can give satisfaction. If results alone matter, what will you do? Probably while correcting the exam papers, you'll somehow make the student pass. The results on the record will be, all your children have passed and all teachers will come and appreciate you. But when you as a teacher perform your duties as an offering, you will know that you will be pleased only when you are sure that you have put in all the best efforts possible, right? So in the end, the student may still fail. You will only feel, okay, maybe I should try something else or some other way of tutoring the child. So the result does not completely become immaterial or irrelevant, but it is given just the practical place it must have to perform your efforts better. So self-satisfaction and a sense of guilt, if I could say that, could be seen as a sign to know how long to persist with efforts. There's one more parameter I would like to mention, and let me continue with the same analogy of the teacher to explain that. Now let's say you being the teacher have taught in the class, you've taken extra classes for this weak student, tried your best to make it easy for that child to learn, and then comes the exams. And let's say you are the invigilator too, as your class takes the exam. You come to this weak student and look over the shoulder of this chap and see that he is still making a mess of his answers. You know, now if the goal of all your efforts was to just make him clear the exam, probably you will just help him a bit, hint an answer here and there maybe. But if you are one who is not making efforts for the result, or in our definition, doing it as an offering, probably you wouldn't do that, right? Because that will not give self-satisfaction. And it will not be the right thing to do and the right offering to make. When you are a teacher in the class, you can have the desire to make the student clear the exam and teach him better. But in the exam hall, your role becomes that of an invigilator. You are not a teacher of that student at that moment. Well, maybe you could pray and wish that the student does well or give him a few reassuring smiles maybe. Same will be the case if you later would be the one who is correcting the answer sheets too. your role changes and you will try to do justice to that role you're playing at that moment. In other words, your efforts of that moment will not be decided by the results that you are seeking, but on what role you are meant to play at that moment. You will perform your duty, or what we call in Sanskrit as kartavyam. And that is why Swami says, kartavyam yogam uchyate. Constantly being diligent in performing one's duty will lead you to union with God. So on one hand, we will be following this inner satisfaction to see if we have made enough effort. On the other hand, we will judge based on what is the need of that moment. What is the duty we are supposed to perform in that moment? And that is why the concept of dharma is so very important and is inextricably related to surrender or spirituality. Surrendering to God does not mean giving up one's duty, but performing them to perfection. Becoming a spiritual person does not mean we give up our responsibilities, but performing them with excellence and, more importantly, with detachment. Going through the whole sequence again, surrender does not mean achieving and then offering to God. It means making the effort itself an offering. What happens? It will firstly reflect as excellence in your effort. Surrender also means, Swami, I made my best efforts. Whatever you give is acceptable to me. This will lead to equanimity and detachment from the result. When the result does not matter, your efforts will be left with two barometers. One is self-satisfaction, and the other is your duty of that moment. These two will decide what actions you do and how long you make efforts and when to let go. Needless to say, all of this does not happen in days, weeks, or even years. It's a very slow process, but you will be able to observe these changes happening within you when you start practicing them. That actually completes the answer that I wanted to give Sister Shruti, but let me also complete a point that I made in the beginning. I had spoken of Vandanam, Archanam and Dasyam, right, as three progressive steps towards complete surrender. I spoke only about the first two. I said Vandanam is we make efforts, achieve the results and maybe then use our status in God's service. Or we say, Swami, with all my achievements, I'm bowing at your feet with humility. Then we spoke of Archanam as a case where as and when we make our efforts, we offer it to Swami and the result or achievement actually becomes Swami's prasadam. But in the process, we saw how we start using our self-satisfaction as a touchstone, right? So we will go about life seeing if we are satisfied after doing a certain action, or is there a guilt or a pricking sensation within. But this satisfaction or guilt is nothing but our own conscience. We will start leading a life strictly adhering to the voice of the conscience. Initially, we will perform actions and see how we feel about it. Are we happy or uncomfortable within? But when we do this over a period of time, we will only act if we are sure that this will be approved by our conscience. In other words, we will start obeying our conscience. Not doing and then checking, but checking and then doing. Every act we do, every choice we make, will now be dictated by our conscience. And this conscience, as Swami has said many, many times, is the divine aspect within, which is the voice of God. So from offering our achievements to God, we move to offering our efforts to God. Now from offering our efforts, we move to doing only those efforts which God prompts from within. Which means, I do what I am instructed to do. I become a servant, a dasa. And that stage is what is called dasyam or servitude. Though I am speaking of these three as distinct stages, it need not necessarily be like that. But as we progress, we will see our nature gravitating towards the higher stages. So final words, first of all, surrender is not inaction. Surrender is complete mindfulness while doing action, complete adherence to duty while making efforts. So how do we know if we still need to make efforts? When you have detached yourself from the results, you will only go by your inner satisfaction and your dharma of that moment. I hope I have answered your question. If you still are not clear or you have any doubts, please do write to me and I'd be glad to address them. that was the question and the answer for the weekday listeners. And now it comes to the point where I promise to share with you a very beautiful and profound incident. Well, this incident was shared by one of our alumnus of the school in the university, Swami's school. His name is Dr. Veerabhadra Rao, and he's from the United Kingdom. He's a doctor there. He's Dr. Veerabhadra Rao. And this was an incident he narrated when he was sharing how his family was drawn to Swami. Well, Dr. Veerabhadra Rao's father was a professor of pharmaceutical science. He had worked in the industry in Bombay and then later moved to Hyderabad as a professor in one of the universities there. And he was, as Brother Veeru, as we would call Veerabhadra Rao, described, his father was a semi-skeptic, right? It's not that he did not believe in Swami, he was not an agnostic, but he was a semi-skeptic in the sense that he was not able to understand many of the rituals and practices that we do, and he would not agree with many of them. He would say that, yeah, there is God and God is protecting us, but why do we do all these things like breaking a coconut and, you know, lighting an agarbati, offering aarti, or making offerings? Why this attitude of bribing God to get benefits from him? And in that sense, he was a semi-skeptic. So one day what happened was he was traveling in an auto rickshaw in Hyderabad, and there was a traffic jam. He was caught in that traffic jam sitting in that auto rickshaw. So he looked at the auto driver and asked him, what's the commotion about? Why are we stuck here? Then the auto rickshaw driver tells him that apparently there is a spiritual gathering going on there, and somebody by the name of Sai Baba is there, and he's addressing the gathering. So here was Dr. Veeru's father, who was sitting in the auto rickshaw, and he heard the discourse from where he was sitting. And exactly at that point, Swami began speaking about, why do we offer agarbatti? Why do we offer coconut? Why do we offer aarti to God? And each one of these practices, Swami started giving a beautiful rationale behind each of them, giving the inner significance and the spiritual significance of each of them. And here was this person sitting in the auto rickshaw, and he was so thrilled to hear that. He said, I've never heard such explanations before. And he was so very impressed with the wisdom which was flowing from Swami, and he decided that the next time when he happens to come across, when he comes back to Hyderabad, and if Swami is also there, he will certainly come and attend the discourses. This was the first time that, you know, this person had a brush with Swami. Of course, he did not even see Swami, but he was so impressed by Swami's wisdom, and that's about all. But going back to the situation in the family, this person had three children, all of them little children, and the youngest child, which he had, which was a boy, was born very normal, but very shortly after he was born, he started developing a very serious skin condition, because of which he would have sores and wounds all over his body, from the head to toe. And as they would describe it, not even a single square inch or square centimeter of the skin was without wounds. There were multiple sores on this body, and there would be bleeding, there would be oozing of pus, and this child was barely 3 or 4 months. So being from the pharmaceutical industry, his father had many, many doctors come and look at this child. He had doctors from Bombay, from Hyderabad and other cities. And all of them said, look, this is a very, very rare condition, and there is no cure for this. There is no way you can completely, you know, put this disease to rest. But what we can do at best is probably offer some steroids to this child. And given that this child is so young, it would probably give a little bit of comfort to the child, but it's just a matter of time before, you know, he contracts some form of infection, because, you know, the skin is open. The skin is probably the easiest way through which an infection can get into your body. And they said, it's just a matter of time before this child contracts some form of infection and eventually succumbs to it. So probably in a year or two, this child should succumb to some infection. So the mother and father were distraught, but they had no other option. They took the chances. One day what happened was an astrologer came to their family. And actually it was an elderly person in their family who happened to be an astrologer. And apparently they had a lot of elders in their family who were good at astrology and palmistry and such sciences. So this astrologer had come, and as I said, this person, the father of this child, was a semi-skeptic, so he did not believe in these sciences. But the mother was desperate, you know. She was looking for any form of help that she could get for this child who was suffering with this very, very weird and painful disease. So she looked at this astrologer and she requested him to make a chart for this child, an astrological chart. So he took the date and time of birth and all of that, and he drew this chart. So she wanted to know from him when this child would be relieved from the suffering, or would he ever be cured at all. So this elderly gentleman was looking at this chart of this child, the birth chart, and he said, "Amma, I don't know about what the chart says," and that's aside, "but I have a strong feeling that on the 7th of April, your child will be cured." And the mother was so happy to hear that. But the father, the skeptic that he was, he said, "How do you say that?" He says, "I don't know. I'm just getting it as an intuition that on the 7th of April, your child will be cured." And this was in the January. This happened in the month of January, and the year was 1973. The child was less than a year old. So the father asked the old man, "That who is going to cure my child?" And the elderly gentleman says, "God will cure the child. God will come and cure your child on the 7th of April. And if you know that many of these astrologers, of course, one is the rationale behind the signs, where they read the different planetary positions and they will tell you about your future and what you should do, what you should not do. But many of these advanced astrologers would have a very keen sense of insight, or the ability to predict things, which is far beyond what the chart actually says. And this person was a very pious man who had this ability. And he said, "Look, I don't know how I'm saying this, but I know it's an insight from within. On the 7th of April, God will cure this child." So the skeptical father says, "So which God will cure my child? Because, you know, in the Hindu tradition, we have many, many gods, 333 crore, as they say." So the father asks, "Which God will cure my child?" And then the astrologer says, "Whichever God you've been worshipping." So then the father says, "We worship Lord Venkateshwara of Tirupati." "And are you saying that Lord Venkateshwara, who is right now sitting on top of the hill in Tirupati, is going to come all the way down, traversing 400 kilometers to Hyderabad, and come and cure my child?" And the astrologer tells him, "Sir, I'm not as educated as you are. I'm not as intelligent as you are. I don't know how he will do it and what will happen, but I only know that it will happen. On 7th of April, God will cure your child." This was the interaction which happened. Of course, the father was very doubtful, but the mother was very happy indeed. But this was forgotten, you know, this was a stray incident which happened. And that year, 1973, Swami was visiting Hyderabad and was staying for a pretty long time, because it was in 1973 that the Shivam Mandir was being inaugurated in Hyderabad. It's still there. It's Swami's Mandir in the city of Hyderabad. So Swami was there, and, you know, Swami was giving darshans every day. So, as I said, this father of this child was drawn to Swami's discourses. So he would go every day, not purely for darshan or, you know, having a chance to speak to Swami, but for this chance of listening to Swami's discourse. And the mother would carry this child along with a fond hope that probably one day Swami would come and grace this child and cure the child. So this was going on when one day a lady in the crowd asked the mother of the child, "Amma, why do you take the trouble of bringing this sick child to this gathering? You know, the child is so uncomfortable and people around are being inconvenienced because of this. Why don't you leave the child at home and come for Swami's darshan?" So the mother was, of course, very hurt by this. So she goes back home and cries to the husband and says that this is what people are saying. So the father says, "Look, I want to go for the discourse. So I will go in the evening. Why don't you go in the mornings?" Because the crowd is considerably less in the mornings. And so it was decided that the father would go in the evenings for the discourse, and in the mornings, the mother would go with the child. So this was followed for a few days, but Swami was not coming to them. Swami was not talking to the mother, and she was not getting any chance to speak to the child, right? So it so happened that it was the last day of Swami's visit to Hyderabad. Swami was leaving on that particular day, and that was the last opportunity that this mother had to pray to Swami to grace her and her child. So she saw that Swami was coming along the lines during darshan, and about 100 yards from where she was sitting, suddenly Swami took a turn and was going away from where she was sitting. So seeing that sight of Swami turning away, the mother lost her patience, and you know, she felt so very pained by it, and she called out. She said, "Swami, Swami, Swami." And Swami, who heard this, stopped, turned back, and started walking towards this mother and child. And as Swami came to her, she was holding this child in her hand, and as I said, this child had wounds all over the body. The body, every inch of skin of the body was filled with wounds. And the skin was oozing pus all the time. So they had, you know, wrapped the child in a white soft cloth. That's how they would bring the child outside, and that's how the mother was bringing the child every day to the darshan. So here was this mother with this child with skin full of pus, wrapped up in this white soft cloth, holding it on her lap. And Swami walks up to her, and Swami opens his arms and says, "Give me the child." So the mother hands out this child to Swami, totally wrapped in this white cloth. And Swami lifts the child, bends down, and whispers in the right ear of the child. Right? This is barely a year old child. It's an infant. Swami whispers into the right ear of the child. In Telugu, Swami says three words. He says, "Tagutadi, tagutadi, tagutadi," meaning it will reduce, it will reduce, it will reduce. Right? And gives back the child to the mother. And the mother is ecstatic. Mother feels that this is it. This was the moment she was waiting for. And Swami walks away after that, smiles at the mother and beautifully blesses her and walks away. So now the mother brings the child back home and she tells the husband, "Swami has cured our child. Swami has cured our child." So the father asks, "Why did he give the child any pendant?" Because the father was thinking that that's the only way Swami cures and blesses children. So she says, "No, Swami did not give any pendant." Then the father says, "Then did Swami give Vibhuti Prasadam?" And she says, "No, Swami did not give even Vibhuti." Then the father says, "How do you say then that Swami has cured your child?" And then she explains that this is what Swami did. Swami picked up the child and whispered these three words in the right ear of the child. Then the father says, "Okay, I mean, it's another event. Let's see what happens." So the next morning, they go to the child, and this was a ritual which they had followed for probably, you know, all through the months of the age of that child. Because this child would be swathed in blood and pus. At nights, what they would do is they would wrap it with a soft white cloth. They would take another soft cloth and tie the hands of the child gently, because otherwise this child would end up scratching itself, and that would become even more serious. So they would wrap this child in this white cloth, tie the hands of the child. And the next morning, what would have happened is the pus would have oozed out of all the wounds, and the cloth will be stuck to the skin of the child. So they had to very gently remove the cloth, and they would bring a cup of glycerin, and they would slowly swathe the skin with this glycerin, and in that way open the cloth which is tied around the baby. And this was a practice which they had been doing for about 7, 8, or 9 months. So the father comes, the two other children usually help the father with this task, and the father starts removing the cloth from the skin of the child. And as they lift this cloth from the child's skin, they realize that there are no wounds. And inch by inch, centimeter by centimeter, they are removing this cloth, and they find that there is not a single wound on this child's skin. And it's almost like somebody has removed the old skin and put a new skin, because, you know, Brother Viru says that he's a doctor. And he knows that even a regular wound, even a small wound, will leave a scar, because this skin does not even have a scar of the wounds which have been a part of this child's skin ever since the child was born. And they were so surprised, because there was not a single scar on that skin. The child's skin was looking like it was brand new. And when they realized, it indeed was the 7th of April. Because Swami had inaugurated Shivam Mandir in that month. I think 3rd or 4th of April was the date. In 1973, Swami inaugurated the Shivam Mandir. And that was indeed the 7th of April when that miracle had happened. And the father went on to say that, you know, "This is the Lord I've been worshipping for 35 years. I've been going to Tirupati. I've been worshipping Mahesh Venkateshwara. And that Lord is actually walking in our midst. He's there with us." And, you know, that's how the course of that family completely changed. Today, Dr. Veerabhadra Rao, Dr. Veeru, whom we for Nicole, he's an elder brother for all of us. He's actually the vice chair of the National Organization of United Kingdom, Satyasai Organization of United Kingdom. And that child whom Swami cured is very much living in Hyderabad even today and is a very healthy, and the problem never returned. You know, when we look at it, do we really realize in whose presence we are living? Do we acknowledge enough whose message we are endeavoring to follow? Because as we mentioned many, many times on this program or many other programs, what is important is that we should follow Swami's message. But that message, that faith in that message, that adherence to that message will never be perfect unless we constantly remind ourselves whose message it is. Who is the one who stood on that podium and gave us those messages? Who is the one whom we worship, right? Because, you know, if we see Swami merely as a guru, as a teacher, then his instructions become lessons. And what really matters is how closely we follow those lessons, how strictly we follow those lessons, right? But the moment we say that Swami is God and this is his message, more than the strict adherence to the message itself, the reverence with which we wish to follow the message, the earnestness with which we wish to be obedient to Swami becomes all the more important than following the message itself. And that is why, as devotees of Swami, I think it's very, very important for all of us to remind ourselves who is this Swami who has entered our lives and how really fortunate we are to have him in our lives. With that, dear listeners, it's a wrap on this week's Radio Sai Answering Booth. This is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and I'm very glad that you all could join me today. I think we might have had some problem with our network today, so I hope you've also downloaded the program and you're able to listen it now. We're sorry about that network problem we've been facing. If you have a question, especially if you have a question on practical spirituality, how do you apply Swami's message in your day-to-day life, how to use Swami's message to solve day-to-day problems, if you have a question in that regard, please send your question to me. I'd be happy to feature it on this program, Radio Sai Answering Booth. All you have to do is send me a mail, and the mail ID you'll have to send it to is prem@radiosai.org. That's prem@radiosai.org. That's my personal mail ID, so the mails that you send to that ID will be read by me alone. So just in case, if you wish to be anonymous, you can mention that as part of your question too. I will play your question, I'll answer your question, but I will not mention your name. That can be done. So I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. I thank you all for being with me. I'm going to leave you with a song. After that, you'll be joined by Brother Raghu for the next program, and after Raghu, I'll be back with you for the afternoon satsang with Brother Arvind. But for the next episode of Radio Sai Answering Booth, you'll have to join me again at 11 a.m. next Thursday. Jai Sai Ram.